The Takeaway is supported by Netflix original documentary series Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On, from Rashida Jones, Jill Bauer, and Ronna Gratis. The series explores sex and technology in a digital age. Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On is now streaming only on Netflix.
Salut, c'est le Takeaway pour lundi le 24 avril 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And which song are we humming today?
I love Paris in the springtime.
Let's gather together to greet the storm.
I love Paris every moment.
Tomorrow belongs to me.
So which standard tune defines the result of the French elections and the runoff to come? Think about it. Some voters are echoing the musical divisions we just heard.
We need a change in leadership, you know, after 5 years, which have not been great, I think, for the country. Now it's a time that we have to think about us, our families and kids, and what we want for them in the future.
We're already lacking behind our key other European countries, and it's time to address a number of issues will change many things in France.
I think Macron is able to deal with the roots of the problem.
Why I'm voting Le Pen? Because socialist is dead, is dying. And in France, is going to die sooner than you think.
Considering elections all over the world and the way they turn, the UK or in the States, I wanted to vote for France and to make sure that we make the good choice.
The inflammatory French satire magazine Charlie Hebdo has a sobbing cartoon prophet on its cover this week, referencing the terrorist attack last week in Paris. But French conservatives are not crying today. In a tense first round of presidential elections, far-right firebrand Marine Le Pen has emerged as a strong number two and will face political novice and centrist and former finance minister Emmanuel Macron in a runoff on May 7th. An up or down vote on the political establishment in France is what nationalist Le Pen has yearned for decades. But there are signs that an aroused French electorate may deliver Le Pen a definitive message on her calls for Muslim deportations and intolerance of diversity. Tomorrow may not belong to her party, says Jean-Marie Potier. He's editor-at-large of Slate France. Jean-Marie, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello.
What do you think was most surprising about this result?
Well, I think the most surprising thing was that many people expected that Marine Le Pen will come ahead in the first round, and she is only she's behind Emmanuel Macron. She's only second.
Does that mean that the alternative to Le Pen is this kind of mishmash of centrist ideas behind the candidate Macron?
Well, I think it's the most suitable alternative right now because if you have a centrist candidate, people from the left and people from the right can more easily vote for him in the runoff. So I think, yes, it's the most suitable alternative right now.
But they'll be voting against Le Pen and not necessarily for Macron. That seems to be a formula for possibly what happened in the United States with Donald Trump.
What happened in the United States cannot happen in France right now because we don't have the same system. If you have more votes, you win. We don't have the electoral college system. And the difference between Macron and Le Pen is far bigger than between Trump and Clinton because right now Le Pen is polling 20 points behind Macron. I think Trump never polled more than 7 or 8 points behind Clinton during the campaign.
Good point. And yeah, in France, if you have the most votes, you win. That is true.
a
slight innovation you have over there. Yes. So what about the shooting? How much of an impact did that have? And of course, President Trump tried to weigh in on that shooting and affect things apparently in favor of Marine Le Pen. What do you think that was all about?
Well, we have to wait for more information and more polls to be sure of that. But I don't think the impact was really, really important because Marine Le Pen was polling at 23, 24, 25% during much of the campaign. And at the end, she only got 21.5%. So in fact, she got a result behind her average. And I think the most important influence of the shooting on the vote was on the turnout because the turnout was bigger than predicted. It was almost 80%. And I think the shooting kind of pushed the people to go to the polls, but not necessarily to vote for Le Pen.
How much of the passions in this turnout related to a verdict on Europe? And it's hard to tell whether this is a pro-Europe, pro-EU vote, or a guarded anti-EU vote.
Yeah, it's quite an ambiguous vote about Europe, because Macron voters are clearly pro-Europe. They want Europe to keep building as it is already. But, for example, Mélenchon voters, they want another Europe, a different Europe, but they don't want a Frexit. They don't want France to exit Europe, to leave Europe. So it's a little bit ambiguous, because you have very strong pro-European views from Macron voters. You have more ambiguous views from Mélenchon voters, or also from Fillon or Hamon voters. And you have very anti-European views from Marine Le Pen voters. But the most important thing, I think, is that Marine Le Pen was more or less in favor of the end of euro in France, to come back to the front. And it's very, very unpopular in France. And I think it made less people vote for her in this first round.
How much of this vote, and how much of the vote on May 7th, is going to be about basic economic issues? There have been strikes over the last year in France, and there's a whole concern about the socialist, the sort of government intervention in the economy, that kind of idea, and there's a thought that that would change, or that that would be strengthened.
I don't think it will be so much a vote about economic, because in fact, if it was a vote about economic, Macron might lose, because he was during 2 years the economy minister of François Hollande. A vote on economy in France is a basic left versus right vote. And what we'll have in the runoff will be more a vote about values and attitude towards society. And there is a new cleavage in France, which is in fact open versus closed society, for example. So it won't really be a vote about economy, I think.
Charlie Hebdo has a picture of Mohammed crying on its magazine cover this week. Any significance to that?
In fact, the campaign was not so much about terrorism until the last 3 days, or about religion. It was really a campaign more about Europe and about economies than about religions and about secularism or about terrorism.
Jean-Marie Potier, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The vote in France can be seen as a repudiation of the longstanding intellectual class and its support for Europe and pluralism. While mostly left-wing, there's also a strong conservative intellectual tradition in France as well. Both have a guarded view of what will happen in the upcoming runoff. Bernard-Henri Lévy is the man behind the well-known byline BHL. He wonders if the strong message of this vote will be lost on passive French centrists. Lévy was born in French Algeria in the 1940s to an Algerian Jewish family. His positions are often controversial. He's been pro-intervention, anti-revolution, and his support of Israel has inflamed the debate on the future of the Palestinians. His latest book is The Genius of Judaism. He says the elections in the U.S. and France are a wake-up call for those who have been blind to the rising tide of anti-Semitism. French Jews, he told us, should be vigilant following this vote.
They probably feel less at home than Jews in America and Jews in Israel. But they are wrong, because they are at home. They built France. Jews made, built, developed France. They made the language, the French language. They made the French literature. They built conceptually the social contract and the Republican idea in France. They were part of the building of the liberal thinking in France. So they feel less at home, but it's a mistake. They are at home, much more at home than the anti-Semites who are un-French, who are not at their place in France.
Why do you think that in the 21st century the French have been more successful than other places in the world in maintaining a coexistence between Jews and other groups versus the kinds of anti-Semitism that we see in Russia to this day, in the Middle East, in even in places in the United States? There's something about the relationship between civic life in France that makes the tension less somehow.
Two things. Number one, nobody is sheltered from anti-Semitism, shielded from anti-Semitism. There is anti-Semitism also in America, as in France. The millions of tweets who followed the election of Trump, all these people like David Duke and others saying we made it when Donald Trump was elected, the denial of Holocaust, which has in America on the West Coast his supposed institutes, all this make that anti-Semitism is as vivid, alas, and living in America than in Europe. The second thing is that in France, the situation, as you say, is less desperate than sometimes the press say it. And it's less desperate because the French elites, the French state, has learned from history, has learned from Second World War and Holocaust. The mistake which was done by Donald Trump on Remembrance Day of Holocaust would not have been done by any president in France, erasing the word Jews in the communique, in the statement. You remember that? Yes. Donald Trump just did not utter the word Jews in the White House statement for Remembrance Day. This is unthinkable today in France.
How would you say the role of Jews in civic society in France is a part of this election campaign? What's going on right now in France?
What happens today with Donald Trump in America, people in the street and so on, happens before the election. If the time happened in any of our country, America or France, if the time came when in which Jews, Israel, anti-Semitism were the core question of the debate, it would be time to pack and to go on the moon, because it will be not only dark times, it would be night, it would be midnight. We are not at this moment. And strangely enough, I believe that the dig, the walls, the levees are holding firm, relatively firm, for the moment.
Where is the Algerian in you?
The Algerian in me is here probably, but I went to Algeria in the midst of the 90s, when there was the birth in Algeria of a new form of jihadism and terrorism. And I made a report for Le Monde, the newspaper Le Monde at this time.
Scary times.
It was scary times. There was very little testimonies about that. It was important because it was the starting point, the stemming cell of what is happening today. It was the birth of ISIS and of Al-Qaeda. And I went in Algeria to report about that. I saw these terrible guys, and I tried to unfold part of the mechanic. It was in Algeria. If Algeria decided to eradicate, as it does today, the Kabyle route, if she decides to forget the French touch, it will be a little Algeria, a shrinked Algeria, a poor spiritual country. It would be such a pity, because it is a great place.
Bernard, thank you so much. It's been a great conversation.
Thanks.
I really appreciate
you.
Speaking with you.
I appreciate it too. I'm happy to be there. Thank you.
Bernard Henri Lévy, French public intellectual, author most recently of The Genius of Judaism. And now, biggest growth industry in the U.S.? Think about it. Who wouldn't want to be part of a trade that has reached the highest volume since the Cold War? An industry that rakes in over $100 billion annually and has created thousands of jobs in over 100 countries. Signs of success? Hard to say. The arms industry is also a cloud that shadows the global economy. An industrial giant, if you look at output, millions upon millions of small arms and tanks, thousands of military aircraft, or even the 14,000 nuclear weapons on Earth, 93% of which are owned by the U.S. and Russia. It's a destabilizing force everywhere in the world. The arms trade enables gun violence, civil war, regional warfare, all of which impose a severe economic penalty on the global economy. Destroying the planet altogether, well, that's a bargain in the math of the arms trade. Less than 100 nukes would do the job. Paul Holden is a historian, researcher, and writer, and editor of the book indefensible seven myths that sustain the global arms trade. Holden says the arms trade makes the world less safe and less prosperous, period.
At current levels and even at the Cold War levels, the size of the nuclear arsenal is just utterly obscene. If there was ever a nuclear war, it would destroy the world 1,000 times over. And I think what happens is that there is a cycle of fear and response that's required from that fear that gets created. During the Cold War, particularly from the American side, there was a very inflated sense of the real threat that Russia posed militarily. And as a result, there was an enormous amount of pressure inside the US to increase the nuclear arsenal, to be shown to be doing something. There's a whole bunch of reasons for that, not least the fact that the arms trade is very good and arms companies are very good at selling their weapons as the solution to insecurity, or selling their weapons as the answer to all situations. There was a phenomenal book by a professor who's now based in London called Professor Mary Kaldor, which she wrote in the mid-1980s. And what that book outlined was the absolute insanity of Cold War arms development, you know, developing weapons that made absolutely no sense whatsoever, were complete sci-fi freak show types of weapons, but absorbed enormous amounts of economic resources. And part of the reason why is because there's such a close relationship between the defense industry and policymakers that when they sell a crazy arms solution to a security problem, the policymakers will generally go with it.
So this is the military-industrial complex argument of Eisenhower, just completely out of control.
Oh, I would totally agree with that. So the United States spends more than the next six countries in the world combined. You know, America spends $600 billion on military spending. To give you a sense of comparison, the next largest is China, which is just over $200 billion in defense spending. I know that Donald Trump has pushed for an increase in the size of the U.S. defense budget of $54 or $57 billion that he's requesting. That is the same size as the entire Russian defense budget. So just the increase that he's requesting, which is not even a 10% increase on the current U.S. defense budget. And I think what's even more remarkable is that it's not, you know, the United States is a huge arms spender, and then you have a whole series of states that are opposed to the United States that are big spenders. If you add in the United States and NATO countries, which are aligned to the United States, they contribute more than 60% of all defense spending around the world. So American defense spending is absolutely enormous. And when you add in their allies around the world, it is completely dwarfs anybody else.
Listen to Dakota Wood, who's a senior research fellow for defense programs at the Heritage Foundation, speaking about military buildup. Does he sound like he's out of his mind?
So it looks like we're policing the world. What we're actually doing is protecting our own interests, because that brings economic life to the United States. It keeps trading partners on our side. We sell our goods and services abroad, and it gives us access to many other regions for raw materials and those sorts of markets.
I mean, there's two elements to that argument that I find very interesting. The one is that the morality of American deployments around the world isn't discussed at all, that it's perfectly appropriate to say, well, we're deploying the military to secure economic gains. But you really have to worry about, you know, what is the military being used for? Is it engaging in gross human rights violations? We see today in Yemen, for example, that there have been at least 10,000 casualties since the Saudi-led coalition led bombing raids on Yemen, 4,000 innocent civilians. The coalition has been targeting, in particular, civilian sites of gathering like hospitals. There is a threatened famine, which could, you know, affect 7.5 to 10 million people. And that's essentially the result of U.S. support for Saudi Arabia and U.S. deployments in the Middle East. It seems to me that there's a strong moral argument against pursuing that sort of line. The second argument is economic, and I don't buy the idea that spending enormous amount of money on weapons and then deploying them abroad to iffy ends that don't necessarily produce security results is good for the economy at all. In certain countries like Libya, there is effectively no government. I'm not sure how on earth you can expect to trade with a governmentless entity that is throwing out insecurity in the region. In the United States, the military-industrial complex absorbs an enormous quantity of resources. And we argue in Indefensible that one of the most persistent myths of the arms trade is that the arms trade is good for the economy, when it's actually the reverse. It absorbs a huge amount of money, and as a job creator and as a technical innovator, it is very poor at that job. If you were to spend $1 billion on defense, according to a study by the University of Amherst, Massachusetts, you create about 12,000 jobs. If you spend the same amount of money on education, it's about 27,000 jobs. So the economic benefits of this I think are illusory. I'm not suggesting that countries entirely demilitarize. I think that's an unrealistic argument in the world that we face, because there are going to be conflicts. What we want to see is defense spending that is actually tied to security threats, and defense spending that increases security rather than decreases security.
Paul Holden, in 10 years, do you think we will have seen the use of a nuclear weapon?
Wow, that's a very difficult question to answer. I would very much hope not. I think that would be a tragedy beyond imagining. I think that the scale of death and destruction that would be produced by a modern nuclear weapon, we have to bear in mind that modern nuclear weapons are considerably more powerful than the weapons that were dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And even those caused just untold devastation. I think I would find it very difficult to see a nuclear conflict between the big nuclear powers that exist. The most likely you're going to see, if there is going to be a nuclear attack, the way it may come about is actually through a program that's been developed in the United States and received a lot of funding under Obama to produce sort of smaller weaponized nuclear weapons that could be used in sort of local regional conflicts. Personally, I have to believe in the essential rationality of humans in the end to pull back from the brink of a war that would destroy everything. I have to believe that the chances are slim, and if we were ever to reach that precipice, that the people in control would recognize the enormity of that moment and find their common humanity.
Paul Holden is a historian, researcher, and writer. He is the editor of Indefensible, Seven Myths That Sustain the Global Arms Trade. He spoke to us from London. Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you much, very much for having me.
Simply talking about arms control handsomely pays lots of journalists and high-level diplomats. But what of the task of taking weapons and actually rendering them harmless, melting them down, burning off their explosive ordnance? Artist Lynn Evola has taken on that mission to make all the arms in the world into art.
If I wanted to create peace angels from New York City to California to Paris to Hong Kong, I could circumnavigate the globe a couple of times and never use all the weapons that the human race has already produced.
Evola's Peace Angels project began in 1992 and has transformed handguns, machine guns, and tons of decommissioned nuclear weapons into small and huge sculptures of peace, she calls them.
I was in a line of people to give speeches when I was a very, very shy artist and didn't want to do speeches, but the project kind of pushed me into it, and there were a lot of politicians ahead of me giving a speech in Los Angeles. And these guys are tough, you know, they've been in the streets of LA. These are really tough guys. And he put his hand on the Mexico Peace Angel, and in front of the cameras, he just burst into tears. I feel that art is the most powerful thing that we have on earth because it engages the consciousness of a person. It shifts who we are as people. That's the power of real art. I was thinking of an image that was something that was above humanity, not a religious symbol, but something that lifted us beyond who we are as human beings, and then used that as a vehicle to basically melt down what destroys us.
The individual you described who put his hand on the peace angel in Los Angeles and burst into tears, why do you think he did that? Did he tell you why? Why he was emotionally affected?
Well, this was a man who was from the Latino community. He was a high-level politician. He had come up through the ranks of conflict resolution and friends getting killed on the street. And when he put his hand on this peace angel, it was made of weapons. And the combination of it just struck him.
If the human race doesn't make it and all that's left is the Peace Angels project and a lot of infrastructure, what will people see? Will it be clear to them that weapons overtook society, or will it be clear to them that they made a serious effort to try to restrain themselves?
Well, that's what I would hope is, again, art has a job independent of me. And that job is the same as the David or the paintings and sculptures that have done by Rodin. And I mean, all those works of art actually have a function. They're there to empower and to engage humanity in our consciousness. Consciousness is the most important thing we have. And I don't know why this is so important, but my hope and my thought is that if we make horrible mistakes, which I am really doing everything I can to deter that, the human beings that would be left would be standing there and inspired in some way and learn what they can to do what they can. Everything is about the cherishing of life in my world.
Lini Vola, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, John.
Lini Vola is the founder of the Peace Angels Project. For images of her work, please visit thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On, a Netflix original documentary series from Rashida Jones, Jill Bauer, and Ronna Gratis, the women who brought you the critically acclaimed film Hot Girls Wanted. The series explores the intersection of sex and technology in a digital age and covers six true stories inside a world that is faking it. A 2017 Sundance Film Festival official selection, Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On is now streaming only on Netflix.
To Washington, D.C. now, where elections have consequences, according to White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney. Told that to the Associated Press over the weekend, echoing President Obama. And apparently, the Obama experience with a government shutdown will be echoed under President Trump. This upcoming Saturday marks the deadline for Congress to pass a new federal spending deal. And a possible bipartisan compromise seems to have been scuttled by the White House coming in and shaking things up. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick is with us. Todd, is it power struggle, government shutdown, power struggle, government shutdown? Pick one.
What it actually seems like to a lot of people in Washington, John, is a last-ditch effort from the White House, from the president specifically, to have a big legislative win to show the base for this first 100 days, which also has its number up on that very same Saturday that you just mentioned. Talks have been going along pretty well, actually, between White House, between Hill Republicans and Hill Democrats over the Easter Passover break. While everybody else was out enjoying the spring, members and their staffs were negotiating a spending deal that looked like it was going to let this one kind of bip along pretty smoothly until the White House and the president came along a couple of days ago and said, oh, no, this spending deal for the government shutdown negotiations that expire midnight Friday night has to include about $1.5 billion for my border wall. Everybody said, wait, what? No, we've already decided to punt on that one so that we don't have a showdown right now. And I'm giving you the voices not just of Democrats, but also of Republicans on the Hill, many of whom would want to build the border wall, John, probably a lot of them would, but they just don't want to have that fight now. And they kind of looked sideways down Pennsylvania Avenue saying, why are you doing this? Why now? You know, here is Peter King. He's from New York. Now, I'm playing you Peter King, former chairman of the Homeland Security Committee, because he's a huge proponent of the border wall. He really wants this thing to be built. But here's what he had to say.
There's going to be compromises going on. But one way or the other, we cannot let the government shut down. And then we have to, once the government is up and running and stays up and running, then we have to just fight this out over the next year.
Does the Trump administration believe that Congress will actually take up the wall later on, or will the punt mean that it just sort of fades into the morass?
Really hard to tell because, as we've learned to expect in this first 100 days, different messages coming from different senior administration officials. Reince Priebus went on TV and took a conciliatory tone saying, well, if we get a little bit of money for border security, that might be good enough. Mick Mulvaney, who you mentioned, the White House budget director, took a harder line stance. The Homeland Security Secretary, a harder line stance. The question is, what would the president do? Now, the president has been on Twitter sending some messages as well, suggesting that he wants to trade dollar for dollar money for the border wall with money that Democrats want. The White House has been threatening to cut what are called cost-sharing subsidies that are under Obamacare. That's money that goes to about 6 million Obamacare recipients, John, to help them afford out-of-pocket costs like deductibles and premiums. The White House is holding the sword of Damocles over some of that money and says, let's go dollar for dollar. The Democrats are saying, we're not playing that game. If there's a shutdown, you guys control all the branches of government. It's you guys who are going to pay for this. I mention Obamacare because at the same time over the break, within the last week, the White House started sending messages through reporters saying that they thought the House was going to vote on another Obamacare repeal this week, that they had reached a deal with conservative Republicans from the Freedom Caucus, and that the House was going to hold a vote. It took about 10 minutes for Paul Ryan's office to shoot back saying, we're not doing that. That's not even in our plans. So a lot of mixed messages as we look forward to this funding deadline expiring on Friday evening and wondering where these negotiations are going to go.
Todd, can the administration do that, go in and do a piecemeal Obamacare change on the subsidies, as you've mentioned, going dollar for dollar on the wall? It's sort of a partial Obamacare repeal. Would the White House, would Congress do that?
They can try. The White House can go out on its own without House Republicans. But listen to Chris Wallace asking Mick Mulvaney what the president will sign.
Will he sign a government funding bill that does not include funding for the border wall?
Yeah, and I think you saw his answer just in your little lead-in, which is, we don't know yet.
It's the budget director. I love that. Mick Mulvaney talking to Chris Wallace. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
You got it.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. A tearful homecoming signals a return to the good old, bad old days in the Middle East.
We are very happy to have Aya back home, and it's a great honor to have her in the Oval Office with her brother, and thank you very much.
Late last week, Egyptian-American aid worker Aya Hejazi was released from the Egyptian jail where she'd been imprisoned for 3 years over trumped-up charges of child abuse at her charity for street children. Human rights advocates have long said the charges were false. The Obama administration had been unsuccessful in negotiating for her release, and the Trump administration celebrated the release and underscored the president's warm relationship with Egyptian leader Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Does this signal a return to the old U.S. policy of supporting dictators in the Arab world? Egypt's state of emergency imposed after the Easter attacks on Coptic Christians expands the government's ability to monitor, imprison, and quickly try suspects in emergency courts with no appeal process. Joining us now, Michael Waheed Hanna is senior fellow at the Century Foundation. Michael, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So is this state of emergency quickly becoming the status quo in Egypt?
It is. I mean, the law itself doesn't actually change much. It gives some expanded powers, but there has been a state of emergency for several years now. Egypt is suffering from a variety of crises, political, social, economic, and security. And these laws are intended more as a kind of symbolic step. But the situation in Egypt is fairly dire.
With Hejazi's return, it's a kind of a full circle where we saw the Obama administration aggressively pursuing electoral democracy in Egypt, then backing away from the Muslim Brothers, a sense that the U.S. was destabilizing Egypt in its support for the Muslim Brothers and in support for the election. And now the Obama administration's lack of success in encouraging human rights under al-Sisi becomes this Trump administration's celebration of a warm, close relationship, but no mention of human rights. Where are we back to?
Well, they've taken a different approach, not just to Egypt, but these issues of human rights and democracy worldwide. And Trump seems to have some sort of proclivity for authoritarian leadership. And so it's clearly a different approach to Egypt. I would say it is not one that is likely to be particularly productive. And we saw the Obama administration struggle with Egypt for years, mostly because Egypt is very hard to deal with. And we see that in the struggles of the Egyptian government. The Sisi regime is not in place and in a position to actually make meaningful material change. And that's not going to be any different under a Trump administration.
Does the al-Sisi government rely on the Saudis for financial support? And that's basically the situation right now?
Well, Egypt-Saudi relations have been quite rocky of late. They seem to be on a better footing. There has been previously big injections of aid from the Gulf, from the Saudis and the Emiratis. But we've seen in those relationships as well that the Egyptian government is unwilling to heed the advice of its closest allies. So it's not just the United States. It's also key Gulf countries as well.
What do Egyptian citizens on the streets of Cairo and even in rural areas, and these are very different points of view often, think about what's going on right now? Are they happy for stability, wary of a new dictatorship? Does it feel like we're back to the Cold War?
Well, it's a slightly catatonic state at the moment, frankly. Politics don't really exist. I think the population writ large is mostly tired, fatigued, beleaguered by regional instability, fearful of what any more political tumult would mean to their own security situation. And they're suffering from really what is now quite acute economic deprivation. Inflation is very high and it's hurting people. But there isn't real capacity for political change. The conditions aren't there. This is a very far-reaching set of authoritarian policies. Repression is quite high. And you put all that together and the conditions aren't right for political upheaval, political change, political opening. But the population is really tired.
I'm wondering if the traditional assumptions about Egypt are suddenly suspect. The U.S. Relied on Mubarak to deliver the Egyptian peace treaty with Israel, relied on it to maintain some sort of security footing to prevent problems in Gaza, which was sometimes successful, sometimes not. Can the Trump administration make that assumption about Egypt now?
Well, they're old assumptions that don't really apply to the present. I mean, the relationship made a lot of sense in 1979 through really most of the Mubarak era. I mean, we saw in the Cold War context where you had Egypt essentially switching sides with the following with the Egypt-Israel peace treaty. The kind of bases of the relationship made sense in a different era. And much of that doesn't apply anymore. The Egypt-Israel peace treaty is secure and Egypt-Israel relations are as close as they've ever been because that's in Egypt's interest at the moment. And that has nothing to do with the United States playing a role in between the Egyptians and the Israelis. And we don't really see any kind of strategic convergence between the Egyptian government and the American government. These are not governments really that share a worldview. And we see that because of the, we see that in the constant tension that we have. We've freighted this relationship with a significance that doesn't accord with the kind of day-to-day of the relationship.
So I wonder if that's another sign of what a lot of people on this program and writers around the region have been saying, that everything in the Middle East right now, or a lot of things in the Middle East right now, can be tracked as a conflict between Iran and everyone else. And you see that in Syria, that's sort of the template, and that's the long-term sort of issue and sort of strategic plan for all of these nations.
Well, Saudi definitely wants Egypt to be part of that grand Sunni alliance against Iran, but Egypt is really on the periphery of that and is on the opposite side of where Saudi wants it to be on Syria. And that's actually been one of the key sources of tension between Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Egypt has traditionally been quite hostile to Iran. But again, it's peripheral to the kind of day-to-day regional conflict and competition that exists between some of the Sunni states in Iran. And really, Egypt has tried to steer clear of actually being directly involved in any sense in direct confrontation with Iran.
Two new authoritarian pillars in the Middle East, Turkey on the one side and Egypt on the other. Is that a way of looking at the 21st century?
Well, it's clearly a reflection of where the region is headed. 2011 seems a long time ago now, and I don't think the conditions will be there in the near future for any kind of political opening. So in an environment of insecurity and economic deprivation and sweeping repression, we should have pretty modest expectations about where the politics of the region are headed.
Sober and sad, I would say.
Absolutely. Again, I mean, I think back to 2011, and that was a genuine opening. I mean, I think this isn't inevitable where we are now, but it is going to be the reality for the foreseeable future.
Michael Waheed Hanna is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Yara Salaam is with one of the few human rights groups still operating as Egypt cracks down. She's the director of the criminal justice program at the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights. She herself was imprisoned from 2014 to 2015 for peaceful protest. Salaam says understanding dissent in Egypt today requires looking back to a hopeful moment, understood by the West as a democratic revolution, but Yara Salaam says, in fact, misunderstood.
I actually don't like the expression of the Arab Spring. It's a foreign term. It's not our context, at least. I think any kind of revolution takes so many years to accomplish the aims at the beginning, at least. I think the revolution still continues. There are many, many people, like hundreds and thousands of people are in jail, and forced disappearances are on the rise for a couple of years now. The economy is not really getting any better. Human rights violations are on the rise and constant, and now we're in a state of emergency. We're actually going backwards at the moment, but I don't think that change is linear. So I think a couple of steps back is completely fine.
You say the revolution is still going on. Does that mean the
uprising that we saw in Tahrir Square is still alive and well?
Well, mobilizing takes different shapes from my point of view. So if we take the example of taking up the squares and protesting, no, it's not happening the same. But people are mobilizing differently at the moment. There are many, many young men and women, like the young generation that who were like 15 years old when the revolution started. They've seen killings of their friends, imprisonments, and so on. This generation will not stop. They do different work. They work on the local level, for example. They look into what their local communities need and what the government is failing to accomplish on the local level, and they do it themselves. So for me, it's a different form of mobilization. It's not always protest, and I don't think protest is the only tool for us to move forward away from what's going on at the moment.
What were you doing in 2011, and how have you changed?
I was walking in Tahrir Square and I couldn't believe the amount of people who are just staying in the street. I started working for a feminist organization, documenting cases of violations for women human rights defenders. I'm a lawyer by profession, so I used to also attend cases, investigations with protesters as well. I think from 2011 till 2013, it was just documenting what was happening.
Every day different. What was it like waking up?
You would never know. This is the thing. I think at the beginning hope was the thing that pushed us forward. But then by the end of 2011, when the violations started to be committed by both the Ministry of the Interior as well as the army officers, the disappointment was getting more to us. By mid-2012, there were many incidents of group rapes for women who were participating in the protests. So that was heavy on everyone. But then, again, people mobilized differently. They did the security groups, intervention groups, to monitor what's happening in the square, and if anything happens, how to get the woman out of the circle, the rape circle.
To try to be vigilant and prevent a rape circle, you know, what do you do? What are you actually doing?
During big events, like big calls of protest, they had like a call group, so they would publish two or three phone numbers for people to call if they see something like that, if they see a circle forming around a woman or more than a woman. And then they have people on the ground wearing specific t-shirts, and they would go inside the circle trying to get the woman out. We worked, when I was working in Nazra for Feminist Studies, we documented a couple of cases with their testimonies and published them, but I was never involved in these groups. I think they're very courageous, but I can never, it's very extremely heavy. I cannot imagine doing it. It's a mob rape. It's not it's not something, I don't think anyone who worked in these groups are able to go on with their lives normally and deal with the streets the way they used to do.
These are collectives of people who are mobilizing locally to prevent violations, to prevent arrests, to document torture, for instance. But do you need a political leader? Do you need a movement in the sort of 20th century model to really confront governments? Or are you just going to stay underground?
First of all, let me just clear up. I don't think human rights activists are the ones who actually pushed for the revolution. What made the revolution happen is that the torture reached an extent where everyone knew that they cannot escape it. When it reached middle class, a boy called Khaled Saeed, he was tortured to death. When people saw that this can be their brother, this can be their fiancé, this can be their neighbor, that they don't only torture quote-unquote criminals, or they don't only torture people's mentality, they would accept that this would happen to people who committed crimes from their perspective.
Is what's going on locally more interesting and more empowering to you than what is going on nationally in a place like Egypt?
For me, it's different. I had a life before the revolution. The generation that started their lives, like they were 15 years old, when the revolution happened, it's a completely different story. I had a job, I finished my master's degree, I had a life before the revolution that I can compare to. But some people don't know anything before that happened. For me, I'm not interested in entering any political party, but still I think we should have a political solution to what's happening. We've always been blamed to, you, the revolutionaries, don't have a suggestion on how to move forward. But of course, like all this amount of people, we don't have any practical way of sitting together and deciding this is the right way to move forward. So I think it's not a good thing. A lot of people say it's completely dirty game, so we're not going to participate in the politics of it. Someone need to come up with a political suggestion.
Do you miss your old life?
No. Yes, I'm sure. I think I'm very proud that I lived through these moments, and I think not a lot of people live that. It's a pride. I'm proud of it.
Yara, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yara Salaam is director of the Criminal Justice Program at the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights, thanks to the Bernstein Institute for Human Rights at NYU Law and their annual symposium, Defending Dissent, for connecting us with Yara. And here are some space milestones to take with you today.
T-minus 10, go for main engine start. We are go for main engine start. T-minus 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff of the Space Shuttle Discovery with the Hubble Space Telescope, our window on the universe.
Today in 1990, the Hubble Space Telescope was launched aboard the Shuttle Discovery, carrying a five-man crew. For 27 years, our eye on the universe has been given a new acuity not seen since Galileo. Hubble orbits the Earth at about 17,000 miles per hour and has produced a photo archive containing more than 140 terabytes of information, adding about 10 more every year. But some kind of system failure is expected to happen between 2019 and 2030. But it's a deliberate abort over near Saturn for the 20-year-old Cassini spacecraft this week, which will begin a meandering plunge into Saturn's atmosphere after delivering to NASA one final mapping of Saturn's moons. Go check out some of those images from Hubble. We're tweeting them. You can find us on Twitter at The Takeaway. That's it for us today. Make sure to get in touch with your thoughts. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet from anywhere in the galaxy. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. By Constant Contact. With email marketing products for small businesses and nonprofits, offering personalized marketing help via phone, seminars, and webinars. More at ConstantContact.com. From Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA believes smart financial decisions should enable life, not define it. TIAA calls this the new success story. Learn more at TIAA.org.